Thank you, audience, for coming to my talk. Ben knows me, but I will introduce myself to you. My name is Anna. I am a graduate student at the University of Utah. I'm finishing this year, and I'll soon be starting a postdoc at the University of Sydney in the fall. So this is talking about my thesis work. And its title is this, A Kozlang-Lustig Algorithm for Whitaker Modules. And so this is my plan for what I was planning on talking about today. And like I said, feel free to stop me, because I think that, yeah, I wasn't really sure who I planned this talk for. But Ben knows my project moderately well, and you don't know anything about my project. And so I will try to somehow balance these two extremes. But I'll start by talking about history and like when people first started talking about Whitaker modules in literature, why people care about them. And then I'll tell three parallel stories that are going on here. There's an algebraic side to this. We'll start with this so we can pose the question. And then there's a different geometric reincarnation of the same story. And so I'll then jump into that, which is all in terms of D modules. And then finally, the answer to the algebraic question we pose is given in terms of combinatorics. And so the third story here is a combinatorial story. And this is really the part that's the algorithm, whatever that means. So everything can be summed up in two sentences, really, which is that we ask a question about representation theory, we give an answer in terms of combinatorics, and the way we go back and forth between the two is through algebraic geometry. So that's the plan. Let's see how we do. We can start with when other people started thinking about this. And maybe the first time that the words Whitaker modules showed up together in the literature was in 1978 in this paper by Costant. And he was asking the following question. He wanted to know which irreducible representations of a Lie group admit what's called a Whitaker model. And so what this is just some realization of the representation. So it's a certain realization as functions, as a space of functions on the group that it's a representation of. And so this was the thing that people were thinking about in the late 70s. They were looking at when they could do this for a representation, when they could realize it as a space of functions on the group. And one reason why this was useful is if it was something like an infinite dimensional representation, this gave us a really explicit model of the action of the representation. If we know how it acted on functions, then we could do, it gave us kind of a foothold in calculations because we had a good handle on the action. So people were thinking about this question, and Costant was one of these people. But in the process of thinking about this question, oh, also the reason why this is carrying the name Whitaker is because when you do this, when you realize a representation this way, the types of functions on the group that you get are these things called Whitaker functions, or they can be expressed as sums of Whitaker functions, which are solutions to some differential equation that was actually studied by the mathematician Whitaker. So there are sort of several steps of being removed from Whitaker himself. But these Whitaker functions show up in lots of other contexts too. They show up in number theory as like Fourier coefficients of automorphic forms or something like this. So they're all over the place, and they're kind of in the background of this story, but they're really very much in the background. Like, Whitaker wasn't so involved in the types of objects that I'm thinking about. And this question actually isn't really what I'm looking at, but in the process of looking at this question, he found an interesting class of vectors. So to answer this question, he realized that it was interesting to look at certain vectors in the representation, which transform in a nice way. So he realized that vectors which transform, maybe this will help now, according to characters of a nilpotent subgroup of the corresponding Lie algebra, or nilpotent subalgebra, transform according to a non-degenerate character of N. And here we have some Lie group. N is just a nilpotent subalgebra of the associated Lie algebra. And so these vectors, if you could find these vectors, they helped in the process of building a Whitaker model for the representation. And so these things he called Whitaker vectors. And then the modules for the Lie algebra that were cyclically generated by these guys, he called Whitaker modules. And I won't write down precisely what Kostin's definition was because mine's going to be a little bit different. But this is maybe the first time that these showed up somewhere in a paper, where these Whitaker modules were useful in looking at Whitaker models and when they existed. But in the process of doing this, what he did is developed a new class of representations of a Lie algebra. So, he defined these Whitaker modules, and now they were sort of around. And then just the next year, people started looking at these modules that had shown up in this context in different ways. So a question that was sort of briefly asked, maybe still being asked at this time, by mathematicians was, if you hand me some nice Lie algebra, like a complex semi-simple Lie algebra, hi, welcome. People were trying to ask if you could classify all of its representation theory. So the finite dimensional representation theory is fine and nice, and you can come up with good descriptions of it. But what if we wanted to classify all the infinite dimensional representations? Well, quickly, this just becomes an incredibly unruly problem that we can't deal with. But at least for the simplest example, it was done in 1979. And it used these Whitaker modules. So all of the irreducible representations of SL2C, Block showed that they were in three different classes. They were either highest weight modules, and this included the finite dimensional case, or they were these new Whitaker modules that were introduced by Kostin, or they were some other family, which was significantly more complicated than either of the first two families. But this kind of distinguished Whitaker modules as a class of representations of a Lie algebra that gave us more than we'd seen previously. So people kept thinking about them in that context. And then what comes next on my maybe somewhat biased timeline here? Next name that I'm going to put on here is this mathematician named McDowell. And he expanded the definition a little bit. So when Kostin defined them, there was this non-degeneracy condition built in. Again, I haven't told you what this means. I'll tell you more precisely later. But McDowell said, we can define the same types of objects, but relax this condition. So he let N act by characters that were degenerate. And then a little bit later in 1988, just not that much later, is really when I intersect this story, even though I was not yet alive. But Milicic and Zorgel started thinking about this class of modules. And what they did is they started thinking about them more categorically. So they defined a category, which they called N, of Whitaker modules. And so their motivation was that for this is they wanted to build on the success of Bernstein-Gelfand-Gelfand category O. And so around this time, there had been a lot of structural results shown for category O, and it was shown to have a really nice structure and be very important sort of in the representation theory literature. And so they were trying to see if they could describe Whitaker modules in a similar type way. So they defined them in terms of some finiteness conditions, which are really similar to category O, and then started asking which of these structure results from category O can lift to this category of Whitaker modules, and started a program of studying them in that way. And this is where my project fits in, really. So I'm interested in studying this category of modules, and I'm interested in structure results. So I'm interested in things like, well, parameterizing the simple objects. That's already been done. But I'm interested in how the simple objects interact with the standard objects in this category, and multiplicity questions in that sense. And so there's maybe one more thing that I'll put on this timeline, 2014. So again, Milicic and Zorgel. And in 2014, they built a geometric machine for studying these things. So all up until this time, it was done very algebraically. People were thinking about these as modules over a Lie algebra. But in 2014, they gave a geometric reincarnation of this category. And they gave it in terms of D modules. And so these are the tools that I used in my project, were this D module version of the category. Okay. So that's kind of where we are up to this point in time, and there are many things that I've left off this timeline of why people care about Whittaker modules and where they've shown up. But for my purposes, this is sort of the story that I've been told, I suppose. But now I can start by actually defining anything I'm talking about. So the algebra, what actually are these? So setup, the setup's pretty standard Lie theory setup. We're going to care about complex, semi-simple Lie algebras. And inside of this, I'm going to fix some Borel subalgebra. And inside of this, we have some corresponding Cartan subalgebra. Okay, these will all play an important role. Then, according, we can take the nilpotent radical of this Borel. Call that N. That's going to be the nilpotent subalgebra that's showing up in my notation. UG is the universal enveloping algebra. And its center is ZG. What else do I need? Floating around in this picture is a Weyl group. Call that W. And we have some nice root system associated to the Lie algebra. And since we've chosen a Borel, we have a selection of positive roots, which I'll call sigmas, and simples, which are capital pi. Cool. So this is all just set up so I can actually tell you what Whittaker modules are and try not to be tripped by this thing. So what is this category? N is a category of G modules. And like I said before, if we're trying to study infinite dimensional representations, they get kind of crazy unless we establish a bunch of finiteness conditions. So the three finiteness conditions that we oppose on these ones are that they're finitely generated, and that they satisfy two local finiteness conditions. So we ask that they're ZG finite, where Z is the center of the universal enveloping algebra. And by this, I just mean that if we look at the orbit of some vector, or if we look at the ZG orbit of some vector in the module, that this thing is finite dimensional. So V is just some vector in the module. So this tells us that the ZG orbits aren't too bad. And we ask the same thing with some control over the action of the universal enveloping algebra of the nilpotent subalgebra. So then this just defines some category of modules, and its objects we call Whittaker modules. So, like I said before, this definition was meant to kind of mimic the definition of BGG category O. And it does. If you just take this second condition and replace it by semi-simplicity for the action of the Cartan subalgebra, then this defines exactly Bernstein, Gelfand, Gelfand category O. But this ZG finiteness is a relaxed condition. And so this category is bigger, but it actually contains category O, the full subcategory. But something of note, maybe, if you're used to thinking about category O, is that when we relax the semi-simplicity of the Cartan to ZG finiteness, we lose weight space decompositions because those were imposed by the semi-simplicity of the Cartan. And so these Whittaker modules don't have weight spaces, but the other conditions give enough structure that that's fine to study them still. But we do have some decomposition. So here's our category. We can break it up into pieces to think about it more simply. So this third condition, the fact that we have some control over the action of N, this immediately results in a decomposition. So condition three leads to the following decomposition. We can write the category as a direct sum of these subcategories, which are parameterized by elements of the dual of the nilpotent subalgebra. And all of these are their blocks of generalized nilpotent character. So these are all the modules that have the property that N acts by these sort of generalized eigenspaces in some sense. So some high enough power of K, X and N, D and D. So all this is saying is that we sort of want that our nilpotent subalgebra just acts by a scalar. It doesn't quite act by a scalar, but it acts by a scalar in this generalized way. And then these are actually blocks of our category. So we can break up the category into these simpler pieces where we know exactly how this piece of the Lie algebra acts. And each of these, it turns out, looks really similar just depending on some condition on the roots. By the way, I also don't know your backgrounds very much at all. My name's Anna. I feel weird that I'm talking to only two of you and I haven't met you yet. What's your name? What was it again?
Farouk.
Yes. Nice to meet you. So we've got vertex operator algebras here. What are you interested in?
The same.
Same thing?
Yes.
So is this all familiar stuff to you guys? Like Lie theory, category O kind of thing? Moderately?
Less.
Okay. So maybe
we're physics species students.
So. Oh, you're physics students.
Yes.
Okay.
But you're interested in something related to this stuff. So.
Okay. Well, I will keep plowing along on my course, but please stop me if something's totally incomprehensible.
I can follow so far. So.
Okay. Cool. So the idea is that we have some category of modules. Maybe it's interesting because some other people thought it was interesting. And we're trying to study it, and so we're trying to break it up into simpler pieces. So far, we can break it up into these pieces where we have a controlled action, a part of the Lie algebra. And each of these guys, each character, so these are all parameterized by elements of the dual. These are just Lie algebra morphisms from N to C. And each of these determines a subset of simple roots. So if we just look at all of the simple roots, so that if we take our character, it's a map from N to C, N just decomposes into the direct sum of all the root spaces corresponding to all of the roots, but it might act trivially on some of them. And so if we take all of the root spaces where it doesn't act trivially, turns out the only root spaces it can act non-trivially are going to correspond to simple roots, but they might not be all the simple roots. And so this one of these etas determines some subset of simple roots. And this subset tells us everything about the structure of one of these blocks. So maybe now it's a good time to sort of pause and examine extreme values. So one of these etas gives us some subset of simple roots. So what happens if it's big and what happens if it's small? So on one end, on both ends, we find sort of familiar categories here. So if eta is non-degenerate, and now I can say exactly what this means. This means that the subset of simple roots that's picked out by eta is as large as possible. It's the entire subset of simple roots. In this setting, this was the setting that Kostin studied originally when he first started thinking about this problem. And it turns out that if we look at the structure of this piece, we look at the structure of one block of this category in the setting, it's a really simple subcategory. So what Kostin did is he defined some standard modules in this category. And he defined them through some sort of induction procedure. So he started with a one-dimensional module over the tensor product of the center in UN. So the center just acts by some element of the dual of the Cartan via the Harshandra homomorphism. And the N acts by whatever our chosen non-degenerate character is. And he induced this upwards and defined a module, didn't give myself enough room, over the entire universal enveloping algebra. So this is just some induction procedure that gives us some module in this category. And these things he called standard modules. And then one of his main results was that these are always irreducible. So there's some class of standard objects. Those standard objects are always irreducible. And furthermore, he showed that this category is actually just equivalent to the category of finite dimensional modules over the center. So this category is really simple. If we fix some infinitesimal character, so we fix the way that the center acts, then our category has exactly one irreducible object. And everything else is just a direct sum of a bunch of copies of that one irreducible thing. So this category is pretty simple. And this category is living inside the one that we care about. So it's living inside of it in these places where our character is non-degenerate. And so that's sort of one extreme. And then the other extreme is also familiar, but less simple. So what happens on the other extreme? So the non-degenerate happened when the subset of simple roots was as large as possible. The other extreme is when it's as small as possible. And so that's just when our character is identically zero. So when it acts as zero in all the simple root spaces, it acts as zero everywhere. And in this case, this block is actually just the category of highest weight modules. So in this case, the structure theory is also established. And maybe familiar. So there's some notion of standard module here as well. There's some standard objects. And they're also defined through some induction procedure. And these are just Verma modules. So the way we get these is we start with some one-dimensional representation of the Cartan. We consider it as a representation of the Borel by letting the nilpotent part act trivially. And then we induce upward. And again, here each lambda is just an element of the dual of the Cartan. And so in this category, we have some standard objects. And these things parameterize the irreducible objects as well. Irreducible modules, these show up as quotients of Verma modules. And then we have a little more structure. Objects here have finite length. So everything in this block of the category has some filtration so that each of the some finite filtration so that the successive quotients are irreducible. And in that sense, it has finite length. We can come up with some finite list of irreducible composition factors that make up any module. And so then if we have a collection of standard modules, a collection of irreducibles, filtration so that we can come up with the irreducibles that construct the standards in some sense, it's natural to ask about multiplicities. So this question, the multiplicity of some irreducible module in a Verma module, this was famously given by this collection of polynomials called the Kostang-Lustig polynomials. So the relationship between the standard and simple objects here is given by some nice set of combinatorial data. It's given by these Kostang-Lustig polynomials, and these are kind of describing the combinatorial skeleton of the category. They tell us how everything fits together. And so this is sort of a nice, maybe familiar story here, and then a nice, even nicer, but maybe less familiar story over there. And both these things are living inside of the category that I'm actually thinking about. They're living in the extreme values. And so what I'm interested in is what happens in the middle. So what happens when our values of eta are not at either extreme? They're not non-degenerate, and they're not zero, partially degenerate in some way. What does this structure theory look like? Are there standard objects? Are there simple objects? And how are they related? So it turns out that much of this has already been done. There's a nice way to define these standards and simples. So a little bit more notation for a second. If we take one of these characters of n, this determines some other nice subalgebras. So it determines a Levy subalgebra, which is contained in a parabolic subalgebra, which is contained in our entire Lie algebra. And here, this Levy is what we get if we just take all of the roots that were picked out by our choice of eta. It determines some subset of simple roots. Those generate an entire root system. We could take just those root spaces, and that gives us a reductive subalgebra living inside of our entire Lie algebra. And if we add in all the rest of the positive root spaces, we get this. We can just think about this. This thing in SLN is some sort of block diagonal thing. This is contained in some block upper triangular thing contained in the entire Lie algebra. And with that, we can define standard objects. So if we're in one of these in-between categories, then a standard Whittaker module is again defined through some sort of induction procedure. We take one of these modules that Kostin defined for, this is an irreducible Whittaker module for the Levy, according to some appropriate choice of parameter. And we do a process of parabolic induction now to get a module over the entire Lie algebra. And this definition specializes to each of those two definitions. And so if we plug in eta that's non-degenerate, then this entire part will vanish because our parabolic will just be the entire Lie algebra, and we'll end up in Kostin's setting. If we plug in an eta that's zero, we end up, this Kostin's module here is just going to be one-dimensional, and so we end up with a Verma module here. So this specializes to either setting. So it's a nice standard object. And we could play the same game we played before. We could look at the structure theory of one of these categories. Standard objects are this. McDowell showed this, actually. And the simple objects are always going to be quotients. So the irreducible modules have the same parameters as the standard modules, and they're unique irreducible quotients of one of these standards. And he also showed that modules here have finite length. So then we could ask the same question we asked over here. We have a nice collection of standard objects. We have a nice collection of simple objects. And everything in the category is finite length. So if you hand me some simple object and some standard object, we can ask what's the multiplicity of that given simple in that given standard. And that's the question. What is the multiplicity of some L U eta in M lambda eta? So this is asking the analogous multiplicity question that was answered over here by the Kostin-Lustig polynomials. And so this is the main question that my project was asking. And there are different ways you can answer this question. And it's been answered before. So one way you can answer it is you can take some of these blocks of this category, and you can build equivalences of categories between these and certain blocks of category O. And then you can force the fact that the answer is already given over here to trace everything back and answer your multiplicity question for Whittaker modules. Or you can answer this thing through a direct algorithm. So what this project does is it develops an algorithm for calculating these multiplicities. And the algorithm spits out some collection of polynomials that are kind of like these Kostang-Lustig polynomials, but slightly different in some way. And those polynomials give us the multiplicities if we evaluate them at certain points. And this algorithm specializes to this case if we restrict to eta being 0. Yes?
These are the modules for the semi-simple algebra, right?
Yes.
So is there a corresponding definition if you consider some affine algebra, for example?
Probably. I mean, I have not written down the definition, but you could write, I mean, you could write down the exact same definition, right? And that would define some sort of category of modules for an affine algebra, but I haven't thought about it. Do you know, Ben, actually? Have people thought about Whitaker modules over affine algebra?
Certain of them, yes. Like, certain of them play a really important role in this geometric language and stuff. But somehow, like, so usually when people are talking about the affine case, and they say Whitaker, they're talking very specifically about the case of like Whitaker for the parabolic, like the parahoric, which is like G of O inside G of K, which sort of plays, sort of gives you some geometric model for like categories of finite dimensional representations.
Maybe one related question. What is the relation between constructing those modules, those particular modules, and the intrinsical reduction? Because it very much reminds me of the intrinsical reduction.
The
intrinsical reduction.
That's a good question. Sometimes Drinfeld-Sokolov reduction.
Oh,
these two modules you are constructing are really like k going to zero construction of the modules for the W algebras.
I mean, I think at least one answer is both of them are kind of versions of Hamiltonian reduction in non-commutative algebras, right?
Okay, so you can think about this one as Hamiltonian reduction?
Yeah, that this is sort of the classical limit of this would be some kind of Hamiltonian reduction.
And by classical limit, you mean what?
I mean in the sense of like the classical limit, like when you take associated grade of the universal enveloping algebra,
okay,
you get algebra.
I see.
Right, that this involves like Hamiltonian reduction for this U of n at different characters, right? We're doing taking this choice of a character of n, so you're doing a Hamiltonian reduction at that value of in the dual of the Lie algebra.
So if you do this Hamiltonian reduction, what happens to the modules? If you start from some algebra,
there are
which modules are transferred into?
Well, the point is exactly these Whitaker modules. They're exactly the things that come from modules over the Hamiltonianly reduced algebra, right? That there's a notion of Hamiltonian reduction of algebras whose sort of classical limit is Hamiltonian reduction of spaces. And one way to think about this definition of Whitaker modules is they're like things that correspond to modules over the Hamiltonian reduced algebra.
Okay, perfect.
Algebra.
Makes a lot of sense.
Okay, thanks.
Cool. We finished the first story. Oh, this is 3. So there is an analogous picture to this using D modules. So let me tell you a bit more notation. I'll let X be the flag variety of our Lie algebra, OX the structure sheaf. And then for every lambda in the dual of the Cartan, Balanson and Bernstein gave us a way to construct some associated twisted sheaf of differential operators. On the flag variety. And then also our flag variety has a nice stratification given by orbits of some unipotent subgroup of the associated Lie group. These are the Bruhat cells. And these have a nice parameterization in terms of Bau group elements. And we'll fix some character of n. So that's the geometric setup. And then we can define another category of modules over these twisted sheaves of differential operators. Ooh. And again, there'll be modules satisfying some certain finiteness conditions. And these will be the geometric analog to the Whitaker modules. So we can look at modules that are coherent. They're going to be modules over d lambda that have some n equivariance condition that's twisted. So this is the category of d lambda modules satisfying, well, first of all, they have to be coherent. This is sort of the geometric analog to the finite generation condition. So coherent d lambda modules, then they need to be equivariant as OX modules. And then finally, the reason why they're twisted is they satisfy this twisted compatibility condition. So let me write it down, and then I'll explain what it means. So in this picture, we've got two actions going on here. We have the action that comes from the differential operators, and then we have an action of a group on the underlying variety, which gives us an action of the group as well on sheaves on that variety. And so we could think about n, the Lie algebra n, as sort of being encompassed in both of these actions. The d lambda action gives us a way that elements, so this, my terrible Greek squiggle, this is just an element of the Lie algebra n. So we have an action coming from the structure as a d lambda module. And then we also have an action which we can get by differentiating the action of this Lie group. So this is the differential of the n action. And the condition we're asking in this category is that these two actions, we don't ask that they agree, we ask that they differ exactly by this character that we've chosen. And so this gives us some sort of twisted compatibility in the structure of these objects, and we call these things, we call these eta twisted Harishchandra sheaves. So this is just some category of D modules, and it has some nice properties. It's not at all clear yet, by the way, that these correspond to Whitaker modules. But what these are is these objects here are holonomic d lambda modules. So in particular, this tells us immediately that they're finite length. So that seems promising, since that was a big thing we needed if we were going to ask multiplicity questions. And but they have irregular singularities. So this is kind of where this story differs from the classical story, if you're at all familiar with how this picture goes for category O. In that case, you end up with some other category of D modules that are not twisted, and those D modules have regular singularities, and then you just keep pushing them through via the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence and think about them as perverse sheaves. But in this setting, the D modules we get have irregular singularities, and so we can't immediately apply Riemann-Hilbert to think about them as some class of perverse sheaves. So because of that, this whole algorithm is developed in terms of D modules instead of perverse sheaf, which is one way that it differs from the classical theory. And it's still a nice category, though. So it still has some notion of standard and simple objects, like the other side. So standard and simples. And a bit more notation. So again, we fixed eta for this whole time. And so from eta, we end up with a smaller Weyl group living inside our larger vowel group that depends on that subset of simple roots, which was picked out by Ada. We can look at the quotient of these two vowel groups, and we can look at a coset in there, and any coset has a unique longest representative. And I'll call that thing WC. I just needed to give you this bit of notation so I could talk about the inclusion of the corresponding Bruhat cell into the entire flag variety. And so for a coset, we get exactly one Bruhat cell corresponding to the longest element in that coset. This is just the inclusion map of that subvariety into the entire variety. And then we use that inclusion map to define a standard object in this setting. So we have a standard Ada twisted Arishandra sheaf. And how we build this thing, so it has three parameters. One parameter is a coset in that quotient. One parameter is some element in the dual of the carton. The last parameter is our fixed Ada. And we start out with the structure sheaf on the corresponding Bruhat cell. But we want this thing to be an object in this twisted category. And so I'm putting an Ada here to remind us that we're thinking about this as a D module, an equivariant D module, where the action of D differs by this Ada. And then we use the machinery of D modules to push this forward using the D module direct image. D lambda module direct image. We push this forward to the entire variety. So this is just some procedure for taking a very simple D module on a subvariety, pushing it forward to the whole thing. And this is how we can define standard objects in our category. And notice that we have exactly this many of them. We have, if we fix some lambda and we fix some eta, we have one of these for every coset in this quotient. And these things have a nice structure. So again, since we're looking at structure theory questions, we can look at the structure theory of this category. We've got some standards, and each of these has, no longer has a unique quotient, but it has a unique subsheaf, which we'll call L. And a nice thing about the structure of geometry is we have a duality. So we have polynomial duality floating around here. And this lets us define a co-standard as well. So on this side, we have three types of objects. We've got standard objects, which are just push forwards of something very simple on a piece of the variety. Then we have unique sub-objects, which are all of our irreducibles. And then we have some duality procedure, which gives us some co-standards as well. So every irreducible shows up as a quotient of the corresponding co-standard. And this is looking promising if we're claiming that this is supposed to be the geometric version of our algebraic category.
Sub of the co-standard?
Quotient of the co-standard. My notation is maybe a little strange. I'm calling the standard object the thing that has a unique irreducible sub.
Oh.
So the co-standard object has a unique irreducible quotient. I know Pramod gave me trouble for this as well. This doesn't match with what the perverse sheaves folks do, but I am following what Dragon does.
Oh,
and Dragon and Wolfgang called these, called the induced, the push forward one standards. But yeah, in like the context of highest weight categories and stuff, if you're trying to think about them in that terms of that, your co-standards in this terminology would be what you would call standards. Yes.
And presumably you could get those by doing co-induction.
Yeah. You could. I guess it's just a matter of preference. This construction before you get to the co-standard part could work on any category of D modules. They don't have to be holonomic, but you only have duality, so you can only do the co-induction if you have the holonomic duality floating around. So from Dragon's perspective, this it's nicer to do the construction that doesn't require holonomicity separately, because you could do it. So I'm not really sure. Matter of notation. Yeah?
Irregular similarity means that it has some sort of high order pole or something?
Yeah, like too high of an order of pole. So it grows too fast. So if you look at like the simplest example, you end up with things that are like exponential functions, sort of.
The general definition is you know what it means to have irregular singularity on a curve because you can look at the order of the pole. On a higher dimensional thing, you look at like all the curves inside it and you look to see if restricted to the curve, you get a bad pole or not. Irregular, if there's some curve or when you're restricted, you get a bad pole.
And you extend this to the whole variety?
Yeah, I mean, this is a notion for a D module in the whole variety that when you when you restrict it to a curve, you always get regular poles, you know, first order poles, or there's some curve where you don't.
So, sure enough, these geometric things do what we want. So if we take some anti-dominant element of the dual Lacartoon, then we look at the global sections of one of our co-standard D modules. This gives us a standard Whitaker module. And if we also ask that our lambda parameter is regular, so it doesn't lie on any of the walls of the chambers in the dual Lacartoon, then we get that the global sections functor takes irreducibles to irreducibles as well. Well, it'll always take irreducibles to irreducibles or zero, but it takes us to the irreducible we want if lambda is regular. So the result of this is that this tells us our original question about multiplicities. We can actually answer it in geometry. And so if we can answer the question about multiplicities of irreducible D modules and co-standard or standard D modules, they have the same composition factors, so it doesn't matter, then we can use this result to pull it back and they'll tell us about multiplicities here. So this succeeds in translating the question to geometry. And then now we're on to part three, combinatorics. Final story. Maybe this could also be subtitled the actual result, the algorithm. So again, a little more setup. In this case, we don't really need to be thinking about the fact there's a Lie algebra. All we need to define this is we need some subset of simple roots. And from this, as earlier, there's some corresponding sub-file group. And we can construct a free module over Laurent polynomials with a basis that's just parameterized by these cosets that we were looking at earlier. So this thing is just a free CQ Q inverse module with some formal basis elements. Okay, so one last bit of setup. This depends on theta. For each one of these and every corresponding simple reflection, we can define an endomorphism of this free algebra or free module. And this endomorphism, we can define it on the basis elements. And what it's going to do is we have three options here. If we take some coset and we take some simple roots and there's a corresponding simple reflection, it's possible that when we multiply everything in that coset by that simple reflection, we stay in the same coset. It just gets shuffled around. Or it's possible that when we multiply everything by that simple reflection, everything in the coset bumps up in the Bruhat order, or it's possible that everything bumps down in the Bruhat order. And so we define our endomorphism differently for each of these. It's either going to be zero in this case, or defined in some way in each of these other cases. Okay, so this is just kind of some combinatorial setup that again seems to have nothing to do with the rest of the pictures. But in this combinatorial setting, it kind of captures the parameters of what's going on in the rest of these stories. And this is where the algorithm is built. So here's a theorem. And this theorem just says that there exists some unique function which takes a coset in this quotient and spits out something in this module, and it satisfies two conditions. The first is that, so it's going to take a coset, and whatever we get, we're going to be able to write in terms of this basis, which is also parameterized by cosets. So if we plug in C to our function, then the coefficient in front of the corresponding basis element is 1, and the only other basis elements that show up here are for cosets that are less than the one we plugged in this Bruhat order, but their coefficients are some collection of polynomials. From the setup, we know that they have to be Laurent series, but the claim is that they're actually just going to be polynomials with no constant term. And the last condition is some recursion relationship. So if we choose a simple root with the condition that it makes our given coset smaller, then there exists some collection of integers satisfying this condition. Okay, so this is just kind of some combinatorial statement. It's saying that we built some module whose base has a basis that sort of seems to have similar parameters to these other algebraic and geometric objects we were thinking about, and there exists a unique function that satisfies these two conditions. If you're familiar with more Kostrzang-Lustig stuff, all of this could be reformulated in terms of Hecke algebras. So these endomorphisms actually generate a Hecke algebra. So you could think about this H theta as not just being a module over the Laurent series, it could be a module for the associated Hecke algebra. And then this statement could be reformulated to be saying there are two different bases of the anti-spherical module of the Hecke algebra, and there exists a unique self-dual basis, and this is the formula you get if you write the self-dual basis in terms of the other basis. So it tells us how two different bases of a module over the Hecke algebra are related. But this is going to answer our question, because these are the polynomials that I claimed were eventually going to show up. I'm going to call them Whitaker Kostrzang-Lustig polynomials. And if we specialize, so this whole thing works for any choice of our theta here, subset of simple roots. If we choose theta to be empty, then in this case, our function is going to be going just from the Weyl group to H. And then this exactly gives us Kostrzang-Lustig polynomials, which answered the multiplicity question for our highest weight category. And if we plug in, if this is as large as possible, if it's the entire subset of simple roots, then this is just going to be 1, and then this is empty. But that also fits with what we saw in Kostin's case, where there's exactly for every choice of lambda, which is kind of floating around in the background here, every standard thing is irreducible. So their multiplicities will be 1. So this question, oh, I should also say, so this is completely combinatorial. It has nothing to do with anything else in the way it's stated. And it can be proven in a completely combinatorial way. And it has been proven in a completely combinatorial way, first by Deodar in 1986, I think, and then in a slicker way by Zorgel in 1997. But the main result of my thesis was an alternate proof of this statement that depends on geometry. And the point of proving it using geometry is that it ties it all back to the algebraic story we were telling originally, and it means that it actually answers our original question. So the way that we can define this using geometry is by defining the function in this crazy way. So the statement is just about some function that satisfies these properties. So we could build this thing using those D modules that we defined earlier. So let's make sure I have enough room. So if we take one of these irreducible eta twisted Harishchandra sheaves, we're fixing a very specific value of lambda, and then we're corresponding to any old coset. We could take this thing. This is an irreducible D module on the entire flag variety. We could use the D-module inverse image functor to pull it back to each possible Bruhat cell. But the D-module inverse image functor is actually in the derived category. So we could take a family of derived functors of this guy. And this just gives us a functor that pulls back to each of the possible Bruhat cells. When we do this, we have some D-module that's n-equivariate, and it's on an irreducible subvariety. So it decomposes into just a direct sum of a bunch of copies of the structure sheaf. We could count how many copies show up in that decomposition. We'll call that the O dimension. That's an integer. That integer is going to be the coefficient of that corresponding term in some polynomial. And then to make this actually land in H theta, we're going to, that's what's going to go in front of our basis element. And so then we sum over all of these m's, and we sum over all of the possible cosets. And this procedure is a procedure for doing at least this thing. It takes some coset and it spits out an element of this. And then you can show, using the structure of the geometry, that this function actually satisfies these two conditions. And so these polynomials tell us they're constructed somehow in terms of these dimensions of D modules. And then the point of doing this is that it answers our original question. So, if we look at a matrix of all of these things, so the matrix that we get, if we just look at all of these polynomials that show up and evaluate them at negative 1, well, this matrix, because of this coefficient being a 1, this matrix is going to have 1s in the diagonal. And because of this condition, it's going to be lower triangular. So this is some lower triangular matrix with 1s on the diagonal. So in particular, it's invertible. We could look at its inverse. I'm just going to call the entries in the inverse MCDs. And then this inverse matrix is just full of integers. And those integers are exactly going to describe the multiplicities that we wanted earlier. So, a corollary to that theorem, if you prove it using geometry, is that the multiplicity of this specific Whittaker module and this specific standard Whittaker module is given by that entry in the inverse matrix. So by looking at this algorithm geometrically, it answers our question about multiplicities. Which was the intended result of this. And it gives a really beautiful answer because it tells us that the answer is in terms of these combinatorial objects, which are polynomials, which can be constructed through some relatively straightforward algorithm. Like this thing could actually just be implemented and you could write down what these polynomials have to be. And then plug in negative 1, take an inverse matrix, and those answer the multiplicity question. So this was the main result. Maybe I'll just say a few words on the proof. Also, I'll finally get to answering what Ben's question was at the beginning. You may have noticed that the setup for this was done a long time ago. So like the original questions were asked in like the late 80s and stuff. So Ben asked why wasn't this part also done a long time ago. And the reason was it because it required the decomposition theorem. So to use this geometric setup, we need some sort of semi-simplicity to get the decomposition that eventually leads to this thing. And in the original Kostang-Lustig setting, that decomposition theorem came in terms of perverse sheaves. And so they took some category of highest weight modules, converted it to a category of D modules. Those D modules had regular singularities. So then they applied the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence to get some category of perverse sheaves, used the decomposition theorem in that setting, and then that answered the question. But for D modules with the regular singularities, there wasn't a decomposition theorem until relatively recently. In 2011, Mochizuki proved this much bigger version of the decomposition that held for D modules, holonomic D modules with regular, irregular singularities. And that's like the main hammer that makes this whole thing go through. And that's the reason why it didn't go through in the early 80s. Maybe one last word on the polynomials. So these polynomials aren't just out of the blue. They have shown up other places in the literature, sometimes called parabolic cross-linguistic polynomials or relative cross-linguistic polynomials, and they can, there are all sorts of combinatorial formulas relating them to regular cross-linguistic polynomials. That you can write them as a sum of regular cross-linguistic polynomials. And this algorithm that describes multiplicities of Whitaker modules is dual to an algorithm that describes multiplicities of generalized Verma modules. If we wrote down everything exactly the same, but replaced this zero with a Q plus Q inverse delta C, there would still be a unique function that satisfied these two conditions, but the polynomials would change. And that slightly different setting describes multiplicities of generalized of irreducible highest weight modules and generalized Verma modules. So that's kind of like a shadow of this singular parabolic duality between those categories. And I think that's it.
But like what, so what map are you applying the decomposition theorem to? Are you looking at like Samuelsons?
So you take, you push and pull to partial flag varieties. You choose like one simple root. Mm-hmm. And you look at, if you take like a single Bruhat cell and then push it down to the partial flag and then pull it back up, you end up with the union of the thing you started with in its closure, or one thing, one less. And then you are going, and then you apply the decomposition theorem on the pushing part of that.
Okay. Tell me, there should be a way to phrase all of this in terms of like translation.
Yes.
Where does this heck algebra come from?
Well, I mean, so these are just exactly geometric translation functors, I guess, is what this pushing and pulling is sort of the geometric incarnation of that.
Any other questions?
Right. Thanks for coming to my talk on this pseudo-holiday, weird timing day.
All right, thank you again.